Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're kicking it off talking about protecting one of your most fundamental rights and privileges as a Connecticut resident and an American, the votes you cast on Election Day. On the heels of a virtual state workshop earlier this week, we're going to chat with the director of the USC Election Cybersecurity Initiative, a brand new nonpartisan independent project working to help protect campaigns and elections. Then we'll move through a busy agenda of subjects with Connecticut's insurance commissioner. We'll talk about new free life insurance coverage for frontline COVID-19 health workers, no-cost coronavirus testing for all, some important things you need to know if you're obtaining life insurance in a COVID-19 world, and what businesses need to know to ensure they have the right insurance coverage as we head into hurricane season. Then we're going to close on this first weekend of LGBTQ Pride Month, jumping into a refreshingly candid conversation with State Representative Raheeb Ali Brennan, who has spent his adult life working with local LGBTQ initiatives and supporting those struggling with stigmas and prejudice as they define their own sexuality. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. CT Folks wants to thank the community for its continued support of their organization and the current rollout of their virtual programming, including the CT Folk at Home concert series. In keeping with CDC guidelines and navigating through an evolving pandemic-driven landscape, CT Folk has made the decision to shift its annual CT Folk Fest and Green Expo, typically held in Edgerton Park in New Haven, to an expanded listening audience with a multi-day virtual platform this September. To learn more and check out the expanding lineup of participating artists, visit ctfolk.org and consider following the festival on Facebook or Instagram at CT Folk. Well, longtime listeners may remember way back before Connecticut went to electronic voting, you used to walk into the big booths and pull the curtain shut and slam those little knobs down. And then we switched to electronic voting. Well, right around that time, the award-winning For the People was kind of on the forefront of media here in Connecticut, really engaging a lot of folks that were involved in not only the mechanical switchover from hand voting to electronic voting, but also involved very much in broadcasting about concerns regarding security of those votes. And I am so thrilled to be able to circle back around to that subject now, because earlier this week, there was a discussion on election cybersecurity with state and local officials and campaign representatives to help improve election cybersecurity in Connecticut. And I am thrilled to be on the line with Adam Clayton Powell. He's executive director of the USC Election Cybersecurity Initiative, and he was the lead on this webinar or this session earlier this week here in Connecticut. Now, as we talked for a few moments before we went on the air, Adam has a wealth of experience from covering 50 years in journalism and technology. He was news manager at CBS News, VP of News at NPR, director of the IMSC NSF Engineering Research Center. He was even executive producer for Quincy Jones and vice provost of global at USC. Adam, wow, what a resume. And I imagine you have miles to go before you retire, right?
Well, John, thank you for having me. And one of my bosses at CBS used to say that I've had all those jobs because I just can't stay at one for more than about 3 or 4 years.
There you go. Itchy feet, right? So what was the, at what point in your life did you become involved and passionate about voting and election security? Is this something that goes back to that first time you walked into a polling place after you turned 18?
Oh, yes. I've always been interested in voting, but had no idea how complex elections really are. Elections are not simple things to run. They're very, very complicated. It takes a lot of people, many of them volunteers, working very hard. So voters only see a little tiny piece of it. Back about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we were interested at USC in creating a project on security of data. And one of the people who became involved was a wonderful, brilliant guy named Vint Cerf, who actually co-created the Internet back in the 1960s. And he's now at Google. And he has steered us over the years in a number of good decisions. And one of the first decisions back in 2015 was we were looking at mobile phones. They said, why are you looking at mobile phones? I said, well, that's because everybody has them, and we need to worry about security. He said, no, you know, you can buy a coffee maker now with an IP address, and LG will sell you a refrigerator connected to the Internet. Shouldn't we be worried about the security of everything connected to the Internet? And everybody around the table nodded. And so that was the beginning of this cybersecurity initiative. And then for 3 years, we've had a partnership with the National Governors Association. And they were the ones, especially after the 2016 election, that really wanted us to focus as their university partner on research on election cybersecurity. And then in January, we launched this 50-state effort. We think we're the only people who are actually going to all 50 states. And now, because of the restrictions on travel and then meetings, we've been doing a number of them virtually. But we want to go state by state to each of the 50 states. We've done about half of them so far. And do two things. One is to present best practices that we've been able to identify with Homeland Security, Defense Department, people at the national level, but also going state by state, we're picking up and learning best practices at the state level. And so in our program on Tuesday in Connecticut, our first speaker was Scott Bates, a friend of mine for some years, who's now the Deputy Secretary of the State of Connecticut. And he gave about a 7-minute description of the things that Connecticut is doing, many of which are brand new, to form partnerships with state and local election officials, with the National Guard, and with private industry to create a much stronger defense against bad actors, foreign and domestic.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I love this this phrase. We talked about another catchphrase that you worked on at another time that has since become globally famous. But I love when you say we're a national campaign and our candidate is democracy. Can you talk a little bit about how democracy has fared in the years since our states have switched over from paper ballots, hand ballots, the clunky machines that we used to have here in Connecticut? How has Connecticut and the United States done in terms of keeping the integrity of the votes that we cast secure and accurate in the days since things have switched over to becoming more electronic?
Well, each of the states is different, and different legal structures, different technologies, different people responsible at the state and local level. As you know, the United States really doesn't hold a national election in November. We're going to be holding thousands of local elections, and then we total up the numbers to learn who the president's going to be. But as a result, we have really had to tailor what we do to each state. And you correctly point out that Connecticut is one of the states that moved from those clunky old machines. And I used to love to pull the curtain, actually, to electronic. And as we've learned, sometimes as you improve the technology, you also have to really up your game in defense, because as you make things more convenient, as you make things more automated, you are introducing new vulnerabilities. And we didn't really think very much about this, or at least 99% of Americans didn't think very much about this until our attention was really focused in the 2016 election, when it was clear that foreign adversaries, or at least one foreign adversary, had the research and development deliberately planned to disrupt elections, not just in the United States, but in democracies all over the world. And what Russia demonstrated was that it is relatively cheap and not that difficult to cause a lot of disruption. We've learned a lot since then, and in Connecticut, over the last, even in the last 12, 18 months, there have been a number of new things put into place to protect the democratic process. And that really plays right to our slogan, which is our candidate is democracy. Mm. We've worked with people to, as we've developed this, this 50-state program, we've worked with people who've run national, state, and local campaigns, and with state and local election workers. And two people who with whom we met back in October, November, have actually run presidential campaigns. One was Bob Shrum, who ran John Kerry's campaign in 2004 and many other Democratic campaigns. And the other was Mike Murphy, who ran Jeb Bush's campaign in 2016 and many Republican campaigns. And I said, you know, we're running a 50-state campaign just the way you guys used to. And they laughed and said, Adam, no one runs a 50-state campaign. The last person who did that was Richard Nixon in 1960. So he's up in Alaska while Jack Kennedy's down in Ohio. Look how that turned out. Mm. But I said, okay, we're running a 50-state campaign, but without a candidate. And Bob Shrum leaned forward and he said, Adam, you're wrong. I said, no, we're nonpartisan. We're independent. And he said, Adam, your candidate is democracy. I said, Bob, I'm going to steal that line with credit. And that's our candidate, democracy, because that is what is being targeted by adversaries, most notably Russia, China, and Iran.
And it's not just the way they can manipulate, influence, or mishandle technology. Your call and your event here in the state of Connecticut earlier this week also focused a lot on misinformation and disinformation. What are a couple of things that you're seeing right now that are concerning in terms of the growing proliferation of misinformation that folks may be very casually exposed to as they scroll through their social network feeds or what have you?
Well, this is changing almost every day because, as I said, our adversaries have R&D budgets. They are using different techniques. And we've seen election disinformation for decades, hundreds of years in the United States. So there's always the October surprise where somebody has an unproven story that they try to use to discredit their opponent. But now with social media, these stories, which might not have seen the light of day. I mean, when I was news director in New York or head of news at NPR, people are always trying to sell us single source stories that were questionable. We would, as good journalists, try to keep them off the air until we had some solid evidence. Well, now with social media, anybody with any kind of disinformation or misinformation can post it. And we use examples in our workshops of a Twitter account that had three followers and posted some spectacular disinformation. In minutes, it suddenly spread to thousands of other accounts. And then from each of those to thousands of more accounts, totally incorrect, totally false, but easy to spread. Homeland Security, their election security people like to use the phrase return on investment. What is Russia's return on investment? And it turns out for disinformation. And it turns out that trying to hack into Connecticut's electronic voting machines, that's not as easy as it looks to a lot of people. It's actually rather difficult if you're properly protected. And so the return on investment means that Russia or China or Iran or anybody has to spend a lot of effort to get into a voting machine and then you have what a few results you're trying to change. Instead, if you can spread disinformation to discredit the democratic process itself, that turns out to be relatively inexpensive and very effective. David Sanger, who covers intelligence for the New York Times, he calls it the perfect weapon. It's cheap and effective.
So how do people catch themselves falling over the cliff, so to speak? Is there some frequently used string of language or tactics, or is just the behavior of, you know, casually surfing or scrolling and getting caught by provocative subject matter all it takes?
What we show in our workshops are some very simple techniques, but they come down to media literacy. When you see something that it looks particularly dramatic, whether you agree or disagree, try to find out what the source is. Now, this is old hat for us journalists, but really everyone now has to be responsible for screening the information that they see and believe. And so you have to do some very elementary checking. Does it come from the New York Times or CBS News? Does it come from, and you have to have your cursor hover sometimes over the originating URL, because it might look like ABC News. In fact, we use an example in our workshop. It looks like abcnews.com, but then it's abcnews.com-, and then it's clear that this comes from another country. It's not from ABC News at all. So there's some simple techniques like that that you can use to verify that what you're seeing is really correct. Also, there's some really good websites that a number of the platforms, Facebook and Google and Microsoft, have tips for checking whether a photograph is real, whether it's been altered, when it was taken, and by whom. So there are technologies that are available to the public that we can use to check the veracity of information that is that's being presented to us.
Yeah, it almost seems like it's become a national pastime also to have one's mobile device or tablet or even desktop, and you're scrolling along like it's a casino machine, like a slot machine, and you're just like kind of it's picking up all these flashing lights and interesting visuals. But I guess the bottom line is that it really takes a little bit more work and a little bit more dedication to be informed if we want to sustain the level of democracy that we've enjoyed here in the United States. You really got to stop and think while you read, and read a little bit more deeply than beyond what you can flash on in a few seconds during a speed scroll session, right?
Well, you're right. And one slogan which we use, and we don't know where it originated, is very simple. Think before you click. Just take that extra second or two to say, is this something that I really want to share or really want to forward on? I don't know if they're using it yet, but I know in the Department of Homeland Security, they were thinking of having a variation on the old Smokey the Bear public service campaign, and it would be only you can prevent misinformation.
Very good. Well, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you, Adam, and I really appreciate you taking the time not only to be part of this statewide event that happened earlier this week, but also the resource that you're providing to all our listeners with some of these tips and ideas and background. There's so much more to know about this organization that Adam is working with, the USC Election Cybersecurity Initiative, and you can find out all about it by going to electionsecurity.usc.edu and learning a little bit more about the work that our guest Adam Clayton Powell III is doing and all of his folks. They're working to be in 50 states before Election Day. They were in Connecticut this week. Adam, we really appreciate the great work that you're doing, and we'll be following to see what more that you and your team have to offer as we move toward Election Day in November and beyond. Thanks so much for taking time with us today.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you. And our sessions are open to the public, so we'll be in, let me think, North Dakota next week. So if you want, anybody wants to join, they can sign up through our website.
Well, I would love to invite anyone in North Dakota who might be listening to the award-winning For the People on our podcast on iTunes or on our radio station websites to participate in that. So thank you so much, sir. Good to talk with you. So as we move into the midpoint of our program this morning here on June 7th, I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of somebody who I've kind of admired from afar as I've been watching the almost daily press avails that Governor Ned Lamont has been doing since the beginning of this whole COVID-19 emergency. And I'm pleased to have on the line the Connecticut's Commissioner of the Department of Insurance, Andrew Mays. Andrew, thank you so much for being part of the program this morning.
Thank you for inviting me, John. Always happy to be on with you.
So lots to talk about. But first of all, something that people may not necessarily relate to the Connecticut Department of Insurance. Let's talk a little bit about the census and some important information that you and your office wants to bring to the people of Connecticut.
Thanks, John. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss the census because, really, you're absolutely right. It is not what you think of when you think of the insurance department. But if the crisis that we've been in over the past few weeks with the virus outbreak has told us anything, it is how important it is to be properly counted so we can get the federal help, we can get the resources that we need when those resources are necessary. Now, I know Lieutenant Governor Bicewicz has been out there, and she's been talking about the importance of having every Connecticut resident be counted. And I think it is absolutely vital that everyone get out there. You can do it online, and starting maybe a week or so ago, for the people that didn't do it online, census takers are going to be going around and they're going to interview you to make sure that everyone is counted. And it's important because it determines how the hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funding is allocated. You know, right now we're trying to work on making sure everyone has a test available to them for COVID, for instance. Part of that is funded by the federal government. Let's make sure we get the resources that we need. Doesn't take much. They're not going to ask about citizenship, and I know that may be a concern for some people, and it's not some database that will ever be used against you. So please, let me just ask everyone who's listening, make sure that you either do it online or when they knock on your door, that you answer. It's important to the state. It's important to your neighbors. It's important to you. Thanks, John.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the lead up to the April 1st kind of launch date, Commissioner Mays, that we had a series of programs on reminding people not only repeatedly to participate and why, but also how to get jobs with the census, other things that they need to know about its implications. And it all kind of went down before COVID-19 really hit Connecticut. But I guess now in hindsight, we see where the allocation of federal funding at the state level really has, you know, it's driven by the numbers that the federal government has from the census in determining the kind of aid that we get. So if the COVID-19 has done no good except to remind us that in order to get the maximum amount of funding we deserve and that each resident of the state of Connecticut deserves, it means every resident of the state of Connecticut has the responsibility to participate in the census, if not for their neighbors and fellow community members, for themselves and their own family, right?
I couldn't agree with you more, John. As you know, we're a net contributor to the federal government. We pay more in taxes than we get back, but let's make sure that we get back as much as we can so the state has the resources that we need to move forward.
Right. Well, for folks that may not be familiar with your department, you still play a very, very critical role because you enforce state insurance laws to help ensure all insurance policyholders are treated fairly. You provide assistance, outreach, and education to help consumers make sound choices, and you regulate the industry in a fair and consistent manner that really promotes market competition for availability of insurance for all of us. Ultimately, your agency's role, while not by name, shares a consumer protection mission. And when we're talking about the COVID-19 emergency, the heroes of that emergency have been the frontline healthcare workers. And I understand one of the things that you really want to talk about this morning is an expansion of free life insurance coverage for these individuals. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. Thank you for the chance on that, John. Now, as I've mentioned to people, I have a personal stake in this. My sister is an intensive care nurse in New York City in one of the hospitals, one of the biggest hospitals in the city, and she's a cardiac intensive care nurse, but she was taking care of COVID-19 patients. And I could hear in her voice as she told me what that was like. I think it is so important that we recognize the sacrifices that the people on the front lines are making. And it is a sacrifice. You know, most of us, let's just, my department, for example, most of us are working from home. We don't have that concern that we go out every day. We don't know what will happen. You know, we don't have to be concerned about bringing something back to our families. These people, and it's, you know, whether they're in the hospitals, they're in nursing homes, they're volunteer EMTs, they're putting themselves on the line for everybody. And that's why it felt good, certainly for me in the department, to be able to support a couple of the insurance companies that have stepped up and that have made it, that have, you know, provided resources for people that are doing this. And one of the ones I want to talk about right now is what you mentioned, the free insurance. MassMutual, which is, as you can tell, a Massachusetts company.
They're the good neighbors.
They've got a number of workers here, and they have a foundation that's headquartered here. And they called me one day out of the blue and they said, you know, we have a program that the Connecticut Insurance Department had already approved that would provide health insurance for people based on need. What if we did this for the healthcare workers? And I said, that would be fabulous. We would get it done right away. Let's see how fast you can get it to us, and we will approve it instantly. They were as good as their word. They got it to us, and we approved it. Now, the only concern at the start was who would be covered, because they had frontline workers, people in hospitals, and so forth. And I kept getting emails from people saying, I'm a volunteer EMT. I may not necessarily be employed. I'm doing this for free. Can I be covered? There were other categories like that, nursing homes, for instance. We went back to MassMutual and we said, this is what we're hearing. What do you think? And they said, let's take a look at this. And they have decided that they will be able to expand the program. So if you go to our website, which is ct.gov/CID, the Connecticut Insurance Department, you can see all the healthcare categories that they've expanded it to. And basically what the program does is it provides free insurance, free life insurance. It depends on your age, and there's an income cap. You have to make roughly less than $250,000. But if you're up to age 50, you get a $25,000 policy, absolutely free, that will cover you for 3 years. If you're 50 to 60, the policy at a face value drops to $10,000. You just go online, you sign up. That's it. There's nothing more that you need to do. It's just a way of them saying thank you. And there is in addition to that, I also did want to mention another company here, Cigna. Cigna and New York Life have created through their foundation. And they've created what we call, or what they've called, and I'm thinking, it's a Brave of Heart Foundation. And what that does is if a family member was a healthcare worker and unfortunately succumbed to a COVID-related disease, they will give the family grants. The first set of grants would be $15,000 to take care of immediate expenses, and then you could apply for more grants up to $60,000 to help cover education and other resources. And if you go to the Cigna website, you can get all the information right there. And, you know, if you unfortunately need it, the application procedure is streamlined.
Yeah, very good.
But, you know, I think it's so good to be able to say thank you in this way.
Very good. Well, we're glad we gave you the opportunity to be able to do that. But also, this is a great, important, vitally important resource for responders and those on the front lines here as we continue to battle the COVID-19 global health crisis. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back to talk with Connecticut Insurance Commissioner Andrew Mays right after this. Stick with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting an awareness or fundraising activity, or you'd like to find one that's supporting a nonprofit in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find out how to promote it or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The International Festival of Arts and Ideas, now in its fifth week of digital and live programming of its 25th anniversary season, has announced details of Virtual Box City. One of the longest-running festival programs, Box City invites children of all ages to create a visionary, temporary, recyclable model city of the future, advised and assisted by local architects, makers, and city planners. This year, there's two ways to participate. Box City at Home invites young entrepreneurs to construct a building with craft supplies and recyclable materials found at home and submit a photo to the city plan, or Box City Minecraft Edition. Anyone with the Windows 10 version of Minecraft can join in constructing a virtual Box City on the Minecraft server at boxcity.org. If you'd like to find out about this and other activities for the Festival of Arts and Ideas, just go to artidea.org. We're talking with Connecticut's Insurance Commissioner, Andrew Mays. Andrew, if you would hang for just a moment, we're going to come back. We've got lots more to talk about for folks here in Connecticut. We're just going to take a very brief break, and we'll be back to talk more with Connecticut's Insurance Commissioner, Andrew Mays. Stick with us. We're back. Thank you for staying with us. We've got Connecticut's Insurance Commissioner Andrew Mays on the line. Andrew, we got some really important information in the first half of the program, and we're going to move on to something that affects a lot more than frontline healthcare workers. I'm talking about eligibility for the expanding number of COVID testing opportunities that are happening here in Connecticut. As we've heard almost daily, if not hourly, it is going to be a extreme proliferation of COVID-19 testing that's going to help Connecticut control this disease and to continue to allow the state to ramp up its economy again by getting people back to and keeping them at work while keeping them and their families and their coworkers, customers, and clients safe. So you had recently announced and reminded all insureds in Connecticut about eligibility for no-cost COVID-19 testing and treatment. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. And that's something, the idea of testing for this virus is absolutely vital, as you said, if we are to keep the state, if we are to open the state and keep it open. And we do need to do that. Back at the start of this, and it's only a few weeks ago, but it seems like a long time ago, Testing was one of the big concerns that we saw. And we spoke to all the insurance companies. We had this discussion. What do we do? Okay. Can we get people? We need to be able to get people tested without them having to worry about the cost. we didn't want anybody to sit home and say, you know, I may have the symptoms, but it's either pay the rent or go pay for a test. We said no. And the insurers all agreed. We came to an agreement on this for all the fully insured in Connecticut. Anybody that's on the exchange, the small, fully insured small group and all that, there will be no cost for testing for COVID-19. So long as you're, it's symptomatic, you want to go get a test. Same thing applies even to the insurers that we don't regulate, which is primarily those large plans that are covered by the Department of Labor. So you've got a huge, you work for a big corporation, the odds are you've got what we call an ERISA plan, which is federally regulated. Same thing there, no copays. Okay, so you don't have to worry about the cost. Go get tested. In addition, if you have a fully insured plan regulated by us, the Connecticut Insurance Department, there will be no cost sharing for treatment. And I said copays earlier, I should say cost sharing, because that means no copays, no deductibles, nothing. So if you have a fully regulated plan, and let's just say, you were trying to save money, you wanted to get a high deductible plan, don't worry about it, okay? You're not going to get billed. The insurance company will take care of everything. So please, don't put yourself at risk. Don't put your family at risk. Get tested.
Very good. One of the other things that maybe people are worried about that your department has helped take care of is people who may have lost jobs that may be taking on new jobs, or people who may have up to this point not been insured for health coverage. They may be getting signed on to new insurance. They may be out there on the marketplace seeking new healthcare insurance. And you issued a warning at some point a short time ago to life insurers about things that they should not be asking applicants for during the interview process. What's that all about?
Yes, I did. And I thought it was only fair to issue a warning that we will not tolerate a mistake being asked about COVID-19. Now, I understand insurance companies will ask you an awful lot of questions when you're applying for life insurance, but from my point of view, we simply do not know enough yet about the virus. We don't know how long it lasts. We don't know what it does. And the fact that you got tested means that, all that means is that you were a good citizen. Are we saying that somebody who didn't get tested and thus doesn't know their status should be advantaged? I don't think so. Part of what we do here, the most important part is consumer protection. And we're going to protect people from discrimination. We are going to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to get the insurance they need. And that includes life insurance, without questions that we just don't know the answers to yet.
Very good. In the final few minutes that we have with you, Commissioner Mays, we want to reach out specifically to businesses, business owners, and business operators here in Connecticut. They've got enough to worry about in trying to get back to work as we still continue to experience this COVID-19 health emergency. But that's by no means the only threat. Hurricane season is starting, and I know you have some important reminders for businesses about verifying the level of insurance coverage that they have if, heaven forbid, they experience some different type of disaster beyond the coronavirus emergency.
Yeah. And that's particularly important this year, John, verifying the coverage that you have, because, frankly, lots of businesses have changed. They may not necessarily have the same liabilities. In some cases, the liability may be greater. In most cases, it may be less. We've all been focused on COVID. But let's not forget, and I think if you're down in South Carolina where that storm hit or is about to hit, or I think it hit last week, you know that we still have the natural disasters that summer brings. Make sure that your coverage reflects your risk. We don't, We absolutely do not want businesses who've already suffered through COVID to sit there and to think, oh, I should have gotten this coverage. Reach out to your agent, reach out to your broker, reach out to the insurance company if you went directly. But make sure that the insurance coverage that you now have will reflect and protect you as a business owner and as a business from the risks that you now face.
Very good. Some very important advice, information, and resources this morning from Connecticut's Insurance Commissioner, Andrew Mays. Andrew, it was so nice to make your acquaintance, and I thank you so much on behalf of all the folks listening and who will tune into the podcast for all this help that you're giving them, not just in relation to the COVID-19 emergency, but in regards to just making sure that they are as protected as they can be in the event of some other type of natural or other disaster. The Connecticut Insurance Department's ultimate goal is consumer protection. They enforce state insurance laws, provide assistance, outreach, and education to help consumers make good choices in regulating the insurance industry in a fair and consistent way, fostering market competition for availability of insurance. If you want to learn more about the Connecticut Insurance Department team and all they do, you can just go to ct.gov or web search the Connecticut Insurance Department. Commissioner Mays, great to make your acquaintance and hope to visit with you again. Thanks for joining us. Well, I'm so pleased to wrap up the program this morning with an individual that I've gotten to know over the past few years. He is one of Connecticut's youngest state representatives. Rahib Ali Brennan represents the 2nd District, which incorporates parts of Danbury, Reading, Newtown, and Bethel. And I just received a outreach from him earlier this week, reminding me that June marks Pride Month. And he issued some interesting and inspiring statements about that based on his experience. So let's talk about that, Rahib. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me, and happy Pride.
Happy Pride. We have been a friend to the gay community on the award-winning For the People for decades here.
Thank you.
And I just want to launch into the conversation talking a little bit about your experience. You're still relatively young, but you probably still came into your own awareness during a time, and you may still be experiencing prejudice today. Tell us a little bit about your self-discovery and the positives and negatives that have kind of defined you in your sexuality.
Oh, very deep, very deep. Well, I mean, I would like to, you know, to note for the listeners that, so I am only one of two openly gay legislators in the entire General Assembly in Connecticut. So, you know, that experience alone is, you know, isolating at times, but we have a lot of great allies. And so, you know, I'm 28 years old. I came out when I was 18 in college in New York City, you know, so, you know, a lot of people don't know what it's like to kind of hold your breath for your whole life, you know, whole youthful part of your life. And then just to kind of rediscover yourself in your early 20s and just how different that is. You don't really get to enjoy those teen years of, you know, finding love and things like that. So just a lot of my experience has been, you know, I'm young, I'm gay, you know, I'm a person of color and my name is different. You know, I was named after a football player. So people sometimes think I'm Middle Eastern. So, you know, post 9/11, that was an experience within itself. So there's been some challenges, but, you know, obviously we've overcome a lot of that. And, you know, I'm a state representative against those odds. And yeah, I'm not sure.
Having the opportunity or taking the opportunity to come out when you were in New York is kind of interesting in that you were in a much more conducive atmosphere to do that in a place like New York. You have to feel for the millions of young people who are your age or much younger who feel compelled to define their sexuality in much more suburban or rural locations in other parts of the country.
In the woods. but yeah, no, I mean, I grew up in Bethel, you know, my whole, you know, I mean, we moved here from Queens when I was in second grade. So, you know, I was raised in Bethel and, you know, it's a small town. And exactly, I just think that's isolating. And, you know, I was able to find myself and have fun in New York City. And, you know, I actually came out because I was dating somebody at the time. It was my first boyfriend. So, you know, I think I was just so happy and, you know, in love at the time that, you know, I started like leaking it to like my cousin was the first person I told because I trusted him so much. And then, you know, as you kind of like are able to slowly get through it, you know, I came out to my parents and, you know, my dad, who is an immigrant, you know, tough guy from Guyana, he's a small business owner. You know, his reaction was the opposite of what I thought it would be. You know, he was very much like he expected it, I guess. And he was just more concerned about my safety. And, you know, at first he didn't really want to talk much about it. I don't think he understood it much, but we're in a great place right now. My mom kind of freaked out. She was, you know, Irish Catholic girl. And, you know, I remember she was just like sitting with it. And then she's like, let's go get in the car. And she actually drove me straight to her therapist, where she actually had her therapist tell me that like I was acting out and that this was just like a phase. And so, it was, you know, obviously difficult to hear that. And, you know, I was just kind of like, no, this isn't a phase, trust me. But, you know, those experiences have helped me, I think, be a better representative because, you know, I'm aware of that. You know, I do a lot of events that are focused on making sure that LGBT youth in the state know that I'm here. I know that, you know, it's hard to have a sense of community when we're all kind of split up here. It's not like there's one big hub of gay people or gay bars. It's all spread out. So I try to do a lot of activities. I was involved with Triangle Community Center, which does a lot of activities in the Fairfield County area. But, you know, obviously we miss some people. And, you know, it's sad to hear that, you know, there was a suicide a couple of years ago in Kent, where it just feels like, you know, there's certain pockets of the state that are not being reached by advocates and by allies.
Well, what could you say to a younger person who is wanting to come out and be themselves, who is then maybe facing the kind of bullying that we hear drives so many young people to harming themselves or heaven forbid, taking their own lives?
I mean, it's scary. I mean, I don't think there's a right answer. I mean, I think people really have to feel out their home situation. I think some of us are, you know, there's the fear that you could be kicked out of your house. You know, when I worked in D.C., I thank my parents at Thanksgiving that, you know, they accepted me because I know a lot of my friends didn't get to go home. And so that's scary. But I think you really have to feel out your home situation. You know, obviously, if there's people you trust, with anything that love you, no matter what, you know, I had my cousin at the time that, you know, I chose him to come out to. And, you know, he, of course, received it and said he doesn't care. And I think you have to find ways like that. But obviously, you have to be true to yourself. You know, I can't imagine, you know, how far that sets you back when you're pretending to be something you're not. And then, you know, in your late 20s, you finally rediscover yourself, how much that sets you back mentally and just, you know, in who you are. So it's tough. It's tough. And sad, but I think we're progressing where people feel more comfortable. And that's why I think it's good that we have people that are public about who they are, to show people that we're all here and there's nothing wrong with it.
Well, 50 years on now with the movement that has become LGBTQ Pride, you know, you've played an important role. The Triangle Center has been a guest on our program before. We've helped promote some of their activities as well as similar organizations in Greater New Haven and throughout the state.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your passion for these organizations and the kind of work that they do. Maybe it will help refer some folks to them that have nowhere else to go.
Yes, I mean, I saw firsthand as a board member of Triangle Community Center, you know, the work that they do and how important, you know, they service Fairfield County. And my job on the board was always trying to push them further up, you know, towards the Danbury area. And one of the greatest things I got to do as a board member was, there was a movie called I Love Simon, which was like a wide released story about a young gay man coming out during high school. And I was able to, you know, through funds that were from advocates and people who cared about TCC, we were able to take a bunch of students from Bethel High School and Danbury High School to see the movie. So it was cool to see them interact, and they all went to the mall and hung out together afterwards. So it was great to facilitate that. But besides that, TCC does important work in regards to health and human services. And, through that experience and learning that there were still gaps that they couldn't fill, especially with the other organizations across the state, myself and Representative Curry passed a bill that's called the LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network Act, which basically it puts money aside to fill those gaps. So right now we have a group that all these organizations come together and they tell us, you know, where do they need help? You know, is it transgender youth? Is it homeless youth? Which we know Connecticut has a big problem with homeless youth. It's higher than the national average. So yeah. I think people think that, you know, gay marriage solved all of the issues for the gay community, and that's totally wrong.
Yeah. In the last few minutes that we have with you, Rahib, talk about a couple of your heroes that you've learned about over the 50 years since the movement started. Maybe someone who's listening might hear about one of them and seek to learn more and, become inspired and feel better about themselves as a result.
Well, obviously, I mean, Harvey Milk is a big, you know, hero of mine. Just, you know, the path he took and his advocacy and his fearlessness and his view of hope, you know, how we have to give people hope to keep going, you know, especially, you know, in times like we are now with COVID and, with its current protests. But I think a figure that I just, you know, have been doing more research on because, you know, we've been talking about the riots at Stonewall, you know, and how those were led. I found about Marsha Johnson. She was a gay liberation activist, and you know, she famously said, "We can't have pride for some of us without liberation for all of us." And so, I encourage people to look up Marsha Johnson, who her whole history and story was is pretty incredible. And the governor Cuomo actually is naming a park after her in Brooklyn, I believe, and it's the first, park to be named after a LGBT activist.
That's fantastic.
In the city of New York, yeah.
And in conclusion, Rahib, where would you advise someone to go if they are feeling desperate or feeling alone or that, like, they can't really talk to anybody about their sexuality that, may be on the LGBTQ line?
I mean, there's the obviously the Trevor Project is a great thing to reach out to. I know Connecticut has a hotline. I actually do have that number available. Where is it? It's the Connecticut Safe Connect. So they have a hotline there where you can speak to individuals, and it's 800-832-1901.
Excellent. Well, you're quick on the draw there, Rahib. And thank you so much for that and your conversation this morning. 50 years on, Connecticut is celebrating this June LGBTQ Pride Month. And our guest this morning has been Rahib Ali Brennan. He has been serving Connecticut as one of the youngest members in the General Assembly, representing the 2nd Assembly District. And he's up for election again in November. Best of luck to you, Rahib, and thanks for the candid conversation, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for highlighting the story.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.